game four this afternoon in New York. NFL Monday Night Football, Tennessee beat Indianapolis 36-22. Now the WGTD Tuesday forecast from the National Weather Service. Sunny and mild, a high of 69. New numbers are in. Right now, wind from the southwest at 13, sunshine at 51 degrees. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg, up next. Support for the WGTD Morning Show comes from the Carthage College Office of Continuing Studies, providing graduate and accelerated certification programs in education to start or advance a career in teaching. Convenient evening and summer courses are designed for the working adult. More information is available online at carthage.edu/grad. Support for the Morning Show also comes from Jack Andrea, a Kenosha tradition since 1911. A unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. Don't forget about Jack's Cafe, Jack Andrea, 2401 60th Street, Kenosha, online at andreasgifts.com.
I'm spending the next few minutes of WGTD's morning show with best-selling author John U. Bacon, who engaged in what had to be one of the most intriguing and exciting and ultimately also heartbreaking experiences of his long successful career as an author. He co-authored a very powerful, poignant memoir called Playing Hurt, My Journey from Despair to Hope, with a good friend of his by the name of John Saunders, one of the best known and most highly regarded names and faces and personalities on ESPN for many, many years. It turns out that beneath that smiling surface, there was a life filled with all kinds of pain and difficulty. And John Saunders decided he needed to sit down and tell this story, and very, very honestly. Sadly, John Saunders died before his memoir could be before he could see the publication of his memoir. But his co-author, John Bacon, saw to it that that the memoir was finished and would be brought to the world. And now, courtesy of Da Capo Press, we can hold this remarkable book in our hands called Playing Hurt, My Journey from Despair to Hope. And John U. Bacon, we welcome you to the morning show.
Greg, thank you very much.
I'm very, very honored to be able to speak with you. Let's begin with how you knew sportscaster John Saunders. Explain to our listeners how the two of you first encountered one another and what kind of friendship eventually emerged.
I'd have to say, Greg, dumb luck to find it. I was at the Detroit News from 95 to 99, and somewhere in there I was part of a celebrity-slash-media hockey game that Dave Coulier hosted. Dave Coulier used to be the uncle on Full House. He's from Michigan, hockey player, and put together this event with a lot of cool folks. Chad Smith, the drummer from Red Hot Chili Peppers, he was our goalie, for example. And we got about 10,000 fans down at Joe Louis, which is the biggest crowd I'll ever play in front of. So I'm getting dressed, and to my left are the Hanson brothers, which if you've seen Slapshot with Paul Newman, you'll know those guys as the guys with the funny glasses and the tinfoil on their hands for fights. And they're to my left, and to my right is John Saunders, and I realize, okay, I'm talking to him. So John and I just started talking. We hit it off and had some mutual friends. He played hockey at Michigan for one semester, so I knew a lot of his friends from there where I skate on Tuesday nights. And we just kept in touch, and after a while we decided to do some books together. one on Madison Square Garden, one on Jim Valvano, who's kind of a surrogate dad of John. And in the middle of this, on September 10th of 2011, John stands up too quickly at the ABC College Football Studios. He blacks out, and we're not quite sure why to this day, although diabetes is probably why, with circulation. And he falls backwards, and John is 6'2", 225, and hits his head very hard on the tile floor, so hard that his concussion, which he thinks is no big deal being a hockey player, causes him to spend 6 weeks at Mount Sinai Hospital in New York, relearning how to walk and talk and read and write. And that will test anyone's mettle, obviously. And what John told me is concussions don't necessarily make you depressed. That's not true. But when you lose your faculties because of a concussion, you're not sure if or when they're ever going to come back. That can make you depressed. And during that stretch, he had to go back and face all his demons from his childhood, from adulthood, and we'll get into those, I'm sure. But that was a very traumatic time for John. When he came out of that, he called me up and said, "We're writing a book about this." And so we did.
So he was eager to tell this story, and you played very little role in terms of encouraging him to do so. I'm not saying you stood in his way, but I mean,
no, I get that, right?
He did not require your encouragement or cajoling. This was a story he was all too eager to share with the world.
Exactly right. In fact, your analysis is spot on, that I'm the guy saying, "Are you sure? Are you sure?" Because the last thing we need is to start a project that in some ways amplifies his depression or other issues. So I said, "You need to go talk to your psychiatrist." By then, he had very good ones, as you know from the book. He had some bad ones, and he had some good ones, but Dr. Carolyn Douglas was fantastic. I said, "You need to go talk to her to make sure this is a good idea." And our deal was working for 4 years on this. If at any point, even after we sign a contract, if we have to give the money back, that's fine. We can't do anything that makes you worse. And Carolyn Douglas was pretty quick in saying, after seeing his reaction and all that, that no, this is exactly what you need and is doing you good. And that being the case, our sessions became quasi-therapy, if you will, and I'm not a trained therapist. I'm a sports writer, man. So that was very good to hear, and I think that was the case throughout the 4 years, that it did John a lot of good. He's very eager to get this book out for two reasons. One is to come clean himself, that he did not want to live a double life, and two, that he wanted to help other people, and that's what's happening now.
Tell us just a little more about the nature of your working relationship. And, I mean, you've already said that it seems to have been very, very important to him and helpful to him on a very personal sort of level, even apart from the central matter of getting this book written. Tell us more about how the two of you worked together and how different this project was from those previous books, which were also collaborations.
Right. Very good question. I would say a few things. One, a bit of background on John. You already know this, of course, but when John and I started talking about all this, I knew a little bit about John's past. I did not know the depth of it, the details. And as you read the book, it's rather shocking what this poor guy had to go through. Physical abuse from his dad. When he's 6 or 7, his older female cousins introduce him and his brother to sex, which can screw you up in a lot of ways. That's going on. In high school, went through self-medication, drugs, self-mutilation, which is usually associated with teenage girls, and of course, concussions and depression. So we got a pretty long list here of pretty much all the most popular psychological maladies, if you will. And so that was not an easy process. And yet, John and I, working on this together, we met in New York several times for 3 or 4 day stretches. We met here in my town of Ann Arbor for 3 or 4 day stretches a couple times. But a lot of it was over the phone or over email, just going over this and that. And given what I just told you over of the subjects involved, as well as John's pretty amazing career at ESPN, how it started, how he got there, and how it works. In addition to all that, working with John, this is going to sound crazy, was a ton of fun. And my wife was always amazed, as John and I sit down in my office here in Ann Arbor, that every 15 or so minutes, John and I would have big belly laughs. And what are you talking about? Oh, his dad, who's a horrible person. So it's pretty amazing that John found ways to laugh in the midst of what I consider some of the toughest circumstances anybody could ever have. And I hope that comes across to the reader as well. So far we're hearing that it has, that it's a book about depression, but it's not depressing. That John's spirit is throughout, and it's pretty amazing what he could pull off.
Absolutely. I completely agree. Generally speaking, are we talking about a collaboration in which he would tell you stories and then you would figure out exactly how to tell those stories?
That's exactly it.
Okay.
Now, once in a while, John would do the writing himself, in which case I'd take it and clean it up and clarify some things. John was a very good storyteller, as you know from sports reporters. He could spin one. Even in 90 seconds, he could tell a pretty good story, which is what it requires in that show. So I was working with a guy who's unusually verbally adept. He had an IQ of 154. I mean, I'm working with pretty good material here. So in that sense, the collaboration was very easy. But I've written, you know, 9 books by now, and John, of course, had not written any. So it was my job to shape those stories, to clean them up. And the biggest thing that a writer can do for a co-author in this case, I think, is structure. Is structure things in a way that the story builds, and that's something you learn over time. The old screenwriter's trick, basically, how to keep some suspense going and making you want to turn the page.
One last question about the collaboration. And, of course, this is really the saddest question that I'll be posing to you, I think, in this interview. The fact already mentioned that John Saunders, unfortunately, died before, I believe, before this book had even really been fully completed. I know he died before it was actually published. Can you just say a word about what this experience was from the point of his unexpected death, which occurred in August of last year, and the means by which you finished this project without your partner and friend?
Yeah, the sad fact is Jen and I thought we were pretty much done by the end of July of last year, which is when I signed my next book contract for a book that comes out November 7th on a completely different topic, The Great Halifax Explosion, which I can tell you about in a second. So John and I are pretty much winding down, so I signed the next contract for a book due in about a year. And then 10 days later, August 10th, John dies of complications due to an enlarged heart, a cardiac situation, which none of us saw coming, of course, least of all John. Truly shocking. Not anything to do with his own hand, which some tweeted out insensitively and utterly inaccurately. The family wisely got a full autopsy performed. So all those technical terms are in the book as to how and what he died of. But I was driving to a speech in Traverse City, Michigan, in northern Michigan, and when I got the news, and I called up Bernie, John's very close brother, as you know, immediately, and asked him about this, and he told me the circumstances, and it's devastating because John was determined, after he had a heart attack in 2012 near the end of this cataclysmic 9 months that we've described, he's determined to enjoy whatever life he had left, and we thought many years at that point. He traveled with his family, his wife, and 20-year-old daughters to Europe a few times. He played more golf with his brother. They'd joined the same club. He was just determined to get the most out of the remaining years. And because he'd more or less surmounted all those things I mentioned, that he'd kind of come through the other side, it's, I think, a very inspiring story that you can get help and it works. And it did for John. And then what happens out of nowhere, of course, when you're guarding the front door, the back door is where things happen, and that's what happened to John. So I'd say that there's a sad part and there's a bittersweet part, if you will. The sad part is simply that John is gone, and it's hard to believe even now, and that he was just about to enjoy all this. And the heartbreaking thing for me is that this would have been John's victory lap, if you will, that he would have gotten the big bear hug from the world. He would have been validated, having come clean, and he's getting that anyway, posthumously, but I'm the one answering these phone calls, not him. Mm. But the bittersweet side is this, and the silver lining is John's second goal is to help people, and the emails I'm getting, the responses I'm getting, the reviews we're getting, calls like yours, Greg, from smart guys and smart stations, that is very gratifying to tell us that we weren't crazy in doing this, that John was right to do this, because a lot of guys, including John Skipper, the CEO of ESPN, told him not to. Don't do this. And John said, I'm going to do it anyway. And I think John was right. And neither John nor I will ever write a more important book.
Hmm. We're speaking with John U. Bacon, who co-authored with John Saunders a memoir of John Saunders' life called Playing Hurt, My Journey from Despair to Hope. One of my favorite chapters is the one titled The Salvation of Sports. in which you say at one point, at their best, sports can provide a rational and sane universe. And the implication of that sentence is that that is maybe especially true for someone whose own personal universe otherwise is not very rational or sane. Just explain the way in which sports did serve as a kind of salvation for young John Saunders in the midst of what otherwise was such a difficult childhood.
Nice job pulling that one out, of course, in a 300-page book. And exactly right. The people I've noticed, and I've read some studies on this, the people I notice who have survived and come out triumphant, if you will, from these horrible childhoods, tend to have an interest outside the family, be it writing or gymnastics or the piano or whatever. For John, it was sports. He's a damn good athlete. Baseball, football, and especially hockey. He played college hockey. His brother is the fifth black guy to go to the NHL. And whenever I say black guy, Greg, in the U.S., everyone says African-American. He said African-American to John or Bernie Saunders. They would say, we're from Canada, we're black guys. It's like, okay. So it's whatever you want. But it shows you how seriously they were as athletes. And for John, that meant for all the weirdness of home, where his dad would often try to bring him down a peg at his greatest moments and beat him up and call him the worst names. And John said the punches didn't last, but the sense of worthlessness was very hard to shake the rest of his life. That sticks with you, because he believed that any 10-year-old, any 8-year-old, if your parents are out of whack, you don't blame the parents, you blame yourself. And I didn't fully appreciate that because my parents were quite good. So you blame yourself, and that stays with you most of your life, sadly. You have to shake that with some help. So for John, sports were the opposite. If you played well, you got more ice time. If you performed well, you scored a touchdown. The points on the board. It's an objective, almost scientific call and response that you do this, you get that. If you play poorly, you lose. And John got a lot of affirmation from his adult coaches, of course, along the way, including Jacques Demers, who ended up being the Stanley Cup champion coach for the Montreal Canadiens. That was one of John's junior coaches growing up. And he described his relationships with these coaches and how important they were, and his teammates, that if you just did your job, they're going to admire you for doing it. And that was not true at home. Home for John was Alice in Wonderland. It was a house of mirrors. Up was down, down was up, and not much made sense. There did not seem to be a cause and effect to your behavior and what happened because of it. So for John, to enter the rational universe of sports was an oasis. And I think that's one big reason why John is attracted to describing it. You're describing a world that makes sense, a world that's just. And one thing that John and I talked about, I'm a white guy, but I've written a lot about Jackie Robinson. There are plenty of racist sports writers in America in 1947 when Jackie Robinson is a rookie. But Jackie Robinson hit like 292 that year, by far the best. He wins the Rookie of the Year because you can't deny the numbers. And that's one thing that's great about sports. And John, as both an abused child as well as an African-American or black guy, if you will, in Canada, those are both salvations, as we say in that title. So it made a lot of sense for John.
You of course explore because he wanted to be very open and frank in this book about, for instance, the kind of substance abuse to which he subscribed in order to escape some of this heartache and frustration in his life. As you've already briefly mentioned, one of the means of escape for him from his pain was actually the self-infliction of another kind of pain in the form of physical self-mutilation. And as you said, we usually think of this with maybe troubled adolescent girls. I was especially impressed that John Saunders was so open about this, because I think a lot of people in his position might have been guarded about having experienced something like this. Can you just say a word about what you think was going on here with this and what it meant for him to be so open about this?
That, of all the things that I heard from John, was probably the most shocking, that John engaged in teenage girls, typically, again, we're speaking stereotypically based on the case studies, will use razor blades on their arms, for example, to draw small cuts, to draw blood. And psychiatrists will tell you it's anger turned inward, that if you can't feel anything else, you'll feel this. If you can't get mad at the world, you get mad at yourself and blame yourself. John used hot wire hangers. He'd heat them up and press them on his thighs, and those scars lasted the rest of John's life. So he did that during his teenage years for about a year or two, I think. And that was anger expressed inward. That was, you can see the damage his dad did, that when you tell your son he's a worthless SOB and so on all his life, after a while he starts believing it. And instead of getting mad at your dad, you get mad at yourself. You take it out on yourself. And John, sadly, found relief in doing this because it was an expression of emotion, an expression of pain that did not get him in trouble with anybody else other than himself. So that's how it worked in John's case. And I'm relying here a lot on a psychiatrist, although I'm a history major, sports writer, and so on. I was smart enough to seek out John's psychiatrist as well as one here in Ann Arbor called Dr. John Graydon, who runs the Depression Center. So I'm not an expert by any means, but hopefully I'm not leading anybody astray here. That's how it works. And John was able to put that behind him over time as well as the drugs. He stopped doing that completely when he met Wanda, his future wife, and they were happily married for a long time. He stopped drinking about 6 years before he passed away on his own for his own reasons. So again, throughout most of the book, all the things that John faced, he was able to surmount one by one pretty incredibly, but it took some time.
Another really shocking moment is when he tells us about his very first encounter with who was supposed to be his roommate at college. That is at the first place where he went to college. And it is a shocking, in-your-face example of really vile racism. Can you just briefly recount this moment from his life and what it says about the role that racism occasionally played in his life and career?
Well, you're right on it. You've read the book very carefully, by the way. I hope all your listeners in Kenosha can appreciate the fact that Greg does his homework. You know pretty quickly in my business if a guy read the book or not, or how carefully. Yeah, he's at Indiana University, which had a club hockey program then and still does, but they're talking about going varsity then. So John goes there at his dad's suggestion, or really kind of his order, and while he's there in his dorm room, he thinks, okay, this could be pretty good. You know, Indiana's a great place. Bloomington's a nice town, all this stuff. His roommate walks in, a big white guy, probably from southern Indiana, who's an lineman on the football team, with his parents. And he says, without even acknowledging John in any way, you know the words, the N-word comes out very quickly, cannot believe they're making me live with an N-word. And John is just sitting there in the bed. He puts his hand out. Even the mom won't take it. And his dad said, we'll get this figured out. And John said, they're talking as though I'm not in this room. It's just an amazing experience. And John said, being from Canada and being a black guy in Canada, he said, racists were like dinosaurs. You heard about them, but you didn't think they still existed. You almost never saw it in Canada. And here he is in southern Indiana, and within 5 minutes, this is what he's hearing. So by the end of that weekend, he decides to transfer to Michigan. And at Michigan, he's got a much better experience with all that the white guys are very receptive. It's some of the black students who are less receptive to John. This is where I think being an African-American in the United States, of course, is very difficult. If you don't get it from white people, you often get it from black people. And that's what John encountered at Michigan as well. So it's not easy being a black person in the United States.
Mm. Well, he ultimately runs into several different kinds of difficulty, including debilitating injuries that really completely derail his hopes for pursuing a career in the NHL. But, of course, another career awaits him in which he enjoyed tremendous success, and that was, of course, as a sportscaster, ultimately leading him to ESPN, his professional happy home for many, many years. What would you say were the most important gifts that John Saunders brought to the task of being a sportscaster? And in what ways was ESPN the perfect place for those talents to be displayed?
Great question, Greg. And, of course, you understand the business. And what we do for a living looks like a lot of fun, and it is. But it also looks easy, and it's not. And when you see people, rookies, take over, you see what the problems are, of course. John stumbled on this career. He starts on Sunday morning on a country station in Ajax, Ontario. He was Country John Saunders, which everyone still laughs about at ESPN. He's spinning Tammy Wynette at 10 o'clock and a Baptist sermon at 10:20, and then Charlie Pride, and then a Methodist sermon at 10:40, and that's how it goes for John. And he's doing it purely as a lark for a few bucks on a Sunday. Seems like fun. It's better than mowing lawns, is what he said. So that's how his career starts, but it turns out that he's damn good at this. And without much effort, he's very good at this. So he bounces around Canada from Sudbury to Moncton, New Brunswick, back to Toronto, and now he's taking it very seriously. He realizes, this is my career. I can do this. And what made him, I think, so good, such a natural so early on? He got to Baltimore next for about 4 years in his early mid-20s or so, working alongside Oprah Winfrey, believe it or not, and then got to ESPN in 1986 at the age of 32, and that's where he was for 30 years. What made him so good? I would say, off the top of my head, having never been asked this before, I'd say three things. One, John was extremely intelligent, and you have to be to do that job truly well. You know from this business, but few others do, and I describe this later on in the book, that to do John's job well, you have to have three records playing in your head at once. One is what the producer is telling you right now, which is yammering in your ear. Well, two is the conversation you're having with the audience. Three is the conversation you're having with your guest, Jesse Palmer, oftentimes on ABC or the sports reporters. And four is what the producer is telling you to do next. So you're keeping all these files in your head going simultaneously. And you got to keep them all sorted out. And if you do it right, it looks very easy. And you've got a waltz going with the listeners, with the guest, and all the rest. But if anything starts scratching, and John's concussion created some scratches in his verbal abilities, things go wrong very quickly. And things did go wrong for John in 2012, and he had to recover from that. But John loved it for that reason. So the intelligence is one thing. I'll say two, he was a perfectionist. And as easygoing as John was in many ways, and his colleagues loved John with no exceptions, they all said if he got mad at you, it wasn't personal, it's because he wanted things done a certain way. So he took it very seriously. And three, I would say empathy. John was a very empathetic guy and was truly interested in what his guests were saying. Otherwise, don't have him on the air. And we've both seen, and you're very good at this, but we've both seen hosts who want to be the guest, basically. So John was able to ask you a question, care about your answer, and stay out of your way. As my dad would say, some people admire the sunset. Some people admire themselves admiring the sunset, and that happens too often, I think, in modern journalism. But John was very good at admiring the sunset and getting out of your way. So John, from a personal level, as a close friend, he was a delight to work with, truly.
Mm-hmm. Well, his memoir is so powerful, and we are grateful for the role that you played in helping make it possible and helping to bring it to the world. Again, the book is titled Playing Hurt, My Journey from Despair to Hope, published by Da Capo Press, and John Saunders' co-author, John U. Bacon. Thank you so much, John U. Bacon, for joining me today on The Morning Show to talk about this very fine book, and best wishes to you.
Greg, thank you.
You are listening to The Morning Show on WGTD HD, your gateway to public radio. I'm Gregory Berg, and now an interview that comes from The Morning Show Archive. For the next few minutes of WGTD's Morning Show, we probe into one of the most important and influential and intriguing figures in all of world history, and yet someone who most of us actually know very, very little about. And probably most of the assumptions we make about this man are based on myth, superstition, and serious misunderstanding. We are going to be talking today about Napoleon. And the reason for our conversation today is the publication of what promises to be the definitive biography of this important figure, a book called Napoleon, A Life, in which we are exposed to Napoleon, who he was, and how he influenced the world in which he lived, and also the way in which he has been so seriously misunderstood ever since. And Andrew Roberts has done a superb job with this marvelous book, and in a sense, it is no surprise. He is a best-selling author of a number of highly regarded books, including The Storm of War, Masters and Commanders, and others, and has done a great deal of work on various historical documentaries, and for many, many years has been interested in Napoleon, collected much memorabilia related to him, visited many of the battle sites and important archives in Europe where much of the information shared in this new book resides, but has never really been disseminated to the public before. Again, the book is Napoleon, A Life. And Andrew Roberts, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thank you very much indeed, Greg. It's a delight to be on.
So, in a sense, this is maybe a pointless question, but I am curious to know why you have been so interested in Napoleon for so long. I mean, not that it's surprising that anyone should be interested in him. There's all kinds of reasons to be interested. But did anything in particular sort of prick your finger the first time and send you on this, what ultimately has been quite a long journey of discovery for you?
Yes. In fact, there was a moment, but it was back in 1973 when my late mother gave me a biography of Napoleon when I was 10 years old. And I read it and loved it, and I've been fascinated by him ever since. Exactly, I've gone back to the book. It's not a terribly good book, in fact, but nonetheless, it was enough to spark the interest of a 10-year-old and keep me really fascinated ever since.
You say something in the introduction to the book that I really have to ask you about. In talking about how much Napoleon has been discussed over the generations, even if the result has been a serious misunderstanding of him, at one point you write, "More books have been written with the name Napoleon in the title than there have been days since his death in 1821. I'm trying to decide if that can possibly be literally true. I mean, I think
it is literally true. Yes, and on top of the many tens of thousands of books written with Napoleon in the title, there have been 3,500 biographies of him. So really what makes mine different, I believe, is that, well, first of all, it's the first cradle-to-the-grave single-volume biography in English to be published since the publication between 2004 and the present day of the 33,000 letters that Napoleon signed during his life. They've been published by the Fondation Napoleon in Paris, a very scholarly institute, and I'm the first historian to be able to write a book on the back of them.
You tell us that among many of these previous books that have been written, that in many cases, if they drew upon correspondence, it was correspondence that had been culled by Napoleon III, and evidently correspondence which was rather seriously mishandled or distorted for the sake of maybe nothing more than simple propaganda. Tell us what has been done in the past, because I think it helps us appreciate then the clarity and truthfulness of what you've done in this new biography.
Yes, some pretty terrible things were done with the correspondence of Napoleon. His, as you mentioned, his nephew, the Emperor Napoleon III, cut out anything that that put Napoleon in a bad light. But it turned out that many of the letters, certainly the sexual letters, he wrote letters of a very erotic nature to his wife Josephine. Those were all the sort of erotic parts were all cut out, and much worse than that, some false letters that Napoleon never read were inserted into the correspondence, which we now can expunge and get rid of, and not take into consideration. So it does require this new set of correspondence, which is unbelievably scholarly, beautifully footnoted, and wonderfully presented. Entirely does change our view of the great man.
Hmm. And in your view, he really was a great man. In fact, one of the central points of your book, to which you return again and again, is the fact that so much of what we take for granted in the modern civilized world, particularly some of the ideas by which many nations govern themselves and sort of handle matters of society and culture, can be traced back to Napoleon. And if he didn't create such ideas, he in many cases really helped expand them or make them more of an intricate part of life. Tell us some of those ideas to which we really owe a debt of gratitude to Napoleon.
Yes, well, of course, Americans had, before the French Revolution, had already had their revolution. So you did have your constitution, an extraordinary document of the Enlightenment. But that wasn't the case in Prussia and Austria and Russia and France at the time of the Ancien Régime. So when the French Revolution burst into the world and set up a series of ideals it wasn't able to keep up to, as the guillotine showed so monstrously fairly soon afterwards. Nonetheless, Napoleon was the person who managed to keep the best ideas of the French Revolution: religious toleration, the abolition of feudalism, equality before the law, these kind of concepts, meritocracy, ideas by which all modern successful modern civilized nations live by today. And he extended them geographically, he codified them, and he protected them, so that when the Bourbons came back to power after his fall, after the Battle of Waterloo, they were not able to put that France back onto the old Ancien Régime. And so as a result, these ideas took root in Europe and managed to extend themselves.
Hmm. We're speaking with Andrew Roberts about his newest book, which is called Napoleon, A Life. Much of what you write in this book helps us cast away some of the ideas which have been in place for so long. I mean, they're practically calcified. And one of them, of course, is that when most of us think of Napoleon, we think of him as, in your words, the quintessential warmonger. When in fact you tell us war was declared on him far more than he was declaring war on others. Help us understand how such a thing can possibly be true, because it feels so wrong or so contrary to what most of us have been told about Napoleon over the years.
Well, that's right. That's right. As you say, it's a good phrase. It has calcified. But the fact is, just because they're called the Napoleonic Wars, it doesn't mean he was responsible for them all. He was responsible for an appallingly opportunistic attack on Spain and Portugal in 1807 and 1808, which went disastrously wrong for him. He was also, of course, responsible for the 1812 campaign against Russia, which broke his army and effectively led to his downfall. But he was not responsible for either of the two wars of the coalitions that started when he was only an artillery lieutenant after the French Revolution. Those were attempts by the Austrians and the Prussians to crush the French Revolution, strangle it in its cradle. He can't be blamed for those. Neither can he be blamed for the subsequent five wars of the coalitions. There were in all seven coalition wars, which were all declared against him rather than him declaring them on anyone else. And he also tried to make peace in each of those five wars. The fact was, though, that he was a great military leader and a great general who knew that in his 60 battles he won. He won 46 of them and drew 7 of them. So he didn't shrink away from an attack when it was made on him. But nonetheless, he cannot be blamed for all of the wars of the Napoleonic Wars.
To what extent was Napoleon revolutionary in his military thinking or in the way that he led troops into battle? Did he operate by the standard practices of the day, but just do it very well? Or were there ways in which he was really, in a sense, an original thinker or innovator in this respect?
It was a little bit of both. After France's defeat in the Spanish War of the Seven Years' War in 1763, a lot of French thinkers, military thinkers, came up with some great ideas for how armies could be modernized. The best idea being the corps system. So instead of having huge amounts of infantry, cavalry, and artillery all separate, you created mini armies, corps, which had a few infantry, cavalry and artillery in them, and they were able, therefore, to maneuver separately and to get to battlefields in such a way that they could outmaneuver the enemy and go round the flanks and so on. And Napoleon, although he didn't invent that concept, was the first person to perfect it and to unleash it on an unsuspecting Europe. By 1812, all the other countries in Europe had adopted it. And, of course, it stayed in the military lexicon until 1945. So he was somebody who didn't originally come up with the idea, but he used it, and he also, through things like speeding up the armies. In the old days, people would stop and besiege cities. He didn't do that. He concentrated on the enemy army, tried to destroy it in the field, and realized that the city would fall afterwards if he had managed to achieve that. So in that sense, he was an innovator as well.
Hmm. You write at one point, Napoleon represented the Enlightenment on horseback. What do you mean by that phrase?
Well, I very much mean the ideas that he took from Rousseau and Voltaire and the other Enlightenment thinkers. These ideas of, as I mentioned earlier, meritocracy and equality before the law, which you didn't see in many of the European states at the time. When he went into, for example, Italy and Germany, one of the first things he would do would be to liberate the Jews. He would let them out of their ghettos. He would stop them wearing the yellow star. He would allow them to have civil and religious liberty. And he would, in places like Malta, for example, stop them from being sold into slavery and allow them to build synagogues for the first time. Now, that is Enlightenment thinking. But it wouldn't have been able to have happened unless he had been on horseback, unless his armies had been successful in the field. So the abolition of the Spanish Inquisition, for example, in Spain, was an integral part of what he was trying to do for Europe.
Hmm. Among the notable events in Napoleon's career was his decision to invade Russia, which you caution us to say was not in and of itself his worst mistake or most foolish mistake, for however disastrous it ultimately turned out to be. There were reasons why he did that. Say a word about this really critical moment in Napoleon's life and career.
Yes. The invasion of Russia in 1812 has been totally misunderstood. It's always been seen by historians as an example of the Napoleon complex. Now, I don't believe Napoleon had a Napoleon complex. I don't believe that one can see hubris leading to nemesis in that classic ancient Greek dramatic trope. In fact, he had perfectly rational, logical reasons to invade Russia. He didn't want to go as far as Moscow. He just wanted to fight a battle on the borders of Moscow, but got sucked further in. But nonetheless, he had an army twice the size of the Russians. He had defeated the Russians twice before. He had no idea that that typhus was going to destroy so many of his men. It was a disease that wasn't even diagnosed until 1911, nearly 100 years later. And he had no idea that the Russians were going to have this scorched earth policy by which they actually burnt down two-thirds of their own co-capital, Moscow. So many of these assumptions made about Napoleon, that he almost went mad with power and became a sort of almost a lunatic at the end of his career, are completely wrong. In fact, he had plans to stop earlier at Vitebsk and Smolensk, which of course he should have done. And he also allowed enough time to get from Moscow to Smolensk, even more time than he had taken getting from Smolensk to Moscow. So the idea that he didn't know that Russia had a bad winter is also an absurdity. No, the major problem came when he took a decision, one of many thousands that he took, of course, as a soldier, after the Battle of Malo Yaroslavets in October 1812, to go north rather than to go west. And he took that decision. It was turned out to be a disastrous one, and it led to the horrors, the cannibalism, and all the rest of the retreat from Moscow.
Hmm. It's so intriguing, isn't it, that when we think of Napoleon, we immediately think of Waterloo. And of course, yeah, we can think of probably a lot of important figures in history whose careers ended with some kind of catastrophic reversal, but it might not be a name that resonates the way the name Waterloo resonates, and it really colors our perception of who he was.
That's right, yes. He most definitely did meet his Waterloo on the 18th of June 1815. And it was a very strange battle, really, in that he broke all of his military maxims, all of the rules by which he had done so well up until then. And only the previous year, in 1814, he had won 4 victories in 5 days. But at Waterloo, it all collapsed. And part of it was, as I say, not just that he was absolutely against one of the greatest, if not the greatest, British general in the Duke of Wellington, but also because he split his army just before the battle, which was a disastrous thing to do. He didn't know where the Prussians were. His intelligence failed him. He started the battle far too late. It was a series of mistakes that that all go against his own military maxims.
Mm. We have to hurry through 2 last questions, and I regret that because they're 2 very interesting matters. One of them is Napoleon and Josephine, and one of the most important things your book does is to sort of recast that relationship, which in your view was in no way a Romeo and Juliet relationship.
It really wasn't. She was unfaithful to him within weeks of the marriage. And he found out 2 years later when he was in the desert outside Cairo. And at that point, he embarked on the first of what I've identified as 22 love affairs with various mistresses. So no, it certainly wasn't Romeo and Juliet. However, they did actually for 10 years have a happy relationship. They got on well. It's a far more complex, far more human, far more interesting story than the classic Romeo and Juliet one.
You have already mentioned the 33,000 signed letters of Napoleon, which you have utilized in crafting this biography. In what way do these letters let us into kind of the inner chambers of Napoleon's soul and heart? I mean, how personal are these letters?
No, it's a very good question. They're immensely personal, all of them. As I say, he signed all of them. They're to his closest confidants, his friends, his mistresses, his wives, his palace officials, his marshals and generals, of course, and his ministers. And they show the passion of the man, a deeply, deeply passionate individual, a one who could write. He had the most beautiful written style, but also a man who could compartmentalize his life and his mind to such a degree that when he's moving armies across Europe, he's also writing to the prefect of Genoa to tell him to stop taking his mistress to the opera. Or when, just before the Battle of Borodino, he is this huge battle is about to start, he's sitting down the night before and writing the rules and regulations of the Comédie Française back in Paris. This is an astonishing account. When the Kremlin is almost burnt down in 1812, and he returns to Moscow and goes back into the Kremlin, which has just been saved from being burnt down, he then actually writes the rules of a girls' school at Saint-Denis outside Paris that he wants to build. I mean, this is an extraordinary mind, a capacity for multitasking, which is truly astonishing.
He's an astonishing figure in many ways. At one point you write, Napoleon convinced his followers they were taking part in an adventure, a pageant, an experiment, and a story whose sheer splendor would draw the attention of posterity for centuries. He was able to impart to ordinary people the sense that their lives, and if necessary their deaths in battle, mattered in the context of great events. They too could make history. The book again is called Napoleon, A Life, and the author, Andrew Roberts. Andrew Roberts, congratulations. You must be so justifiably proud of this accomplishment, and I'm so glad we got to talk today on The Morning Show about your marvelous book. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Greg. I really appreciate it. Great honor.
Support for the WGTD Morning Show comes from Jack Andrea. a Kenosha tradition since 1911. A unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. Don't forget about Jack's Cafe, Jack Andrea, 2401 60th Street, online at andreasgifts.com.